Welcome back to all of our travelers. And we are back into Perek Chet. That's where we're up to.
It's like
Alice in Wonderland.
You have to run very, very fast just to stay in the same
place.
That's right.
Stay still.
Well, we could go quickly, but there would be, you know, you'd lose the flavor of it.
This is great.
You'd lose the flavor of it. All right. We had spent some time talking about the various questions or challenges in this parak with regards to Shmuel's reaction to and God's reaction to the request of the people for a king. The basis for that request seems to be motivated by the behavior of Shmuel's sons, although that seems to be somewhat of a non sequitur in terms of the disconnect between the problem and the solution. Exactly. And so we had come up with various issues in terms of, we compared it to the mitzvah in the Torah, and the discussion around whether or not there's a mitzvah in the Torah to appoint a king, the discussion whether it's a positive commandment or only a concession type of commandment. We identified the fact that the Rambam, and therefore the Halacha, and really the Pshat and the Chumash, seems to side with the position that it's a mandated obligatory mitzvah, which only strengthens the question of why there's such a negative reaction to the request for a king. And that's sort of where we began to delve into the sort of beginning of a solution to the dilemma textually. And the first thing that we saw was a statement in the Gemara, which is really where we sort of left off, that there are in fact two different themes or issues going on in this parak. And that there is the conversation Shmuel is having with the Zkenim and the conversation he's having with the people. And there's a very different tenor to that conversation. The way the Gemara puts it, Zkenim Shebador Shalu Kohogen, the elders, when they came to Shmuel, they came respectfully and they came with a very legitimate request. And we have to explore what that request was. But the Ameha Aretz, as the Gemara calls it, the people of the land, meaning the Amcha, the masses, they had a different agenda, and they, the Gemara says, Ameha Aretz Shebehem Kilkulu, the Ameha Aretz, they destroyed the agenda, they derailed the agenda, if you will. And that led us to a conversation as to what exactly is the difference between the request of the Zkenim and the request of the people. That's sort of where we left off, and we're going to look at that now and begin to explore the issue.
Did you talk about why they're called people of the land?
I briefly touched on the reference to the language shift between biblical language and rabbinic language, that there are certain terms that shift in time based on how they're used. In Tanakh, Ameh Aretz refers to nobility. In the language of Chazal, Ameh Aretz refers to ignorant masses.
Okay.
There's a reason for that. The actual technical translation of Ameh Aretz would translate most loosely into the farmers, right? The farmers are the shepherds. And in Tanakh, who are the nobility? The wealthy people who had land, they were the nobility, and the landless
nomads,
paupers were not. Whereas in the time of Chazal, the sociological structure had changed so dramatically that the shepherds and the farmers, they were the ignorant, you know, masses, and the nobility had a different socioeconomic structure. Mm-hmm. So that's a function of the language shifting over time. Whenever you find in rabbinic literature the reference to Ameh Haaretz, it's always a reference to either the masses or the sort of a generic picture of the people without, less sophisticated. contra distinction to the Zkenim, who are the more learned or the more aware or the more or the leadership. In the context of this parak, that's all, we'll go back and look at this psukim again. The context of this parak, the parak doesn't use the word Amei Haaretz. What it does say is that there's one conversation with the Zkenim, and there's another conversation with the Am. And the Am certainly would refer to the sort of the masses out there as a kind of a generic picture. So take a look. Let's go back and just review those.
No question. The nobility, how was that structured? How were part of the population nobility?
I just use that term loosely. In other words, people who are more engaged, more learned, more involved, more the Zkenim in this case. The phrase it was a tangent just to explain how the word Amei Haaretz gets shifted in time. That phrase doesn't appear in the parak, so it's not really.
Okay,
because that's what the Gemara uses. The Gemara talks about the Zkenim and the Amei Haaretz, but the language in Chazal is referring to a certain.
But the Zkenim are always like scholarly, more.
The Zkenim are usually either the Sanhedrin or the scholars or the elders of the community. The
leaders,
right. So if you take, let's go back to Perek Chet and let's look at those psukim again, because it's going to actually sort of address it a little bit. I want to segue into one very important textual issue. So we're going to jump around a little bit. We are going to start with Pasuk Dalet. Vayidkabtzu kol ziknei Yisrael vayavo el Shmuel Ramata. That's the reference to the Zkenim. The elders, the Zkenim of Israel, came to Shmuel. And that's the only place in this parak the word Zkenim appears. This is the beginning of the conversation with the Zkenim. And they said, V'yemu ela v'ne'ata zakanta, uvanecha lo'ochu b'dvachecha, ata simu lanu melech l'shofteinu k'chol agoyim. You, Shmuel, have gotten old, or getting old, your children, although he was died, according to Chazal, he died at the age of 52, as we said, so everything's relative. Uvanecha lo alchu bidvachecha, your sons are not living up to their expectations. Ata simu lanu melech l'shofteinu k'chol agoyim. We want a king to judge us like all the nations. Vayira davar b'nei Shmuel kasher amru, tna lanu melech l'shofteinu v'yipalel Shmuel al Hashem. This was ill in the eyes of Shmuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. God's response, Pasuk Zayin, Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Shma b'kol ha'am, l'chol asher yemru elecha. Ki lo otcha ma'asu, ki oti ma'asu mimloch aleihem. Listen to the people, they're not rebelling against you, they're rebelling against me, they are rejecting me. This is much more significant than you think. And that's where the Gemara points to the suggestion that what God says to Shmuel is that there's another conversation going on here. You think it's just about your sons, and the Zkenim who are coming to you to say, we need Shoftim, who aren't going to be susceptible to bribes and susceptible to power, and we want a melech who's going to be able to judge us without having to worry about collecting, getting his paycheck from the litigants who come before him. We want a melech because he's financially independent of the litigations. You think that's what it's about? And that's what's bothering you? That they're upset about your sons? This is much more significant. It's like, you have nothing to be upset about. You want to be upset? Go listen to what I have to deal with. Go listen to the people. Shema b'kol ha'am. And then you'll hear a very different agenda. They abandoned me, they rebelled against me, they worshipped idols. Now they're doing that to you. Go listen to them. So Shema B'Kolam means two things, and I think there's a pun going on here. There's a sort of a double entendre. Because Shema B'Kolam means, listen to them means acquiesce to their request. Right? Heed their request. But Shema also means, Shema Yisrael also means, listen, right? You're not listening, you're not hearing. You're hearing only half the conversation. Shema b'kol ha'am, open up the window and listen to what the people outside are saying. Go read the signs of the placards and at the protest rallies, and you'll hear a very different agenda. And now, Ha'ed b'hem migadet alehem mishpat ha'melech. Go tell them what the rule of the king is. Go read them. Go teach them what it means to have a king. And that's a piece of it we're going to come back to. What is this mishpat ha'melech? What's its significance? And we're going to look at that perhaps today. So again, Pasuk Yud, Vayomer Shmuel et kol divrei Hashem el ha'am ha'sho'alim me'ito melech. Who's he speaking to?
Yeah.
The conversation with the Zkenim is over. He doesn't go back to it. This is now the conversation with the Am. And he reads to them Mishpat HaMelech. We'll skip it for a moment. Jump to Pasuk Yutet. Vayimanu ha'am lishmo b'kol Shmuel. People refuse to listen to Shmuel's chastisement when he says to them, you don't really want a king. You want a king, be careful what you wish for. He's going to oppress you. He's going to take your possessions. He's going to take your sons and your daughters, and you'll have no freedom. Vayamru lo ki imelech yaleinu. We want a king. Vayinu gam anachnu kuchalagoyim ushvatanu malkeinu meratzalifaneinu minachamet milchamoteinu. We want a king. We want to be like all the nations. We want a king to judge us, to be a warrior before us. Vayishma Shmuel et kol divrei ha'am. Vayedabrem bozne Hashem. He heard the words of the people, took him back to God. Vayomer Hashem el Shmuel, Shma b'kolam, again, okay, heed their request. Vimlach talehem melech. So, three times he talks to the people, the Am. There's a clear distinction, says Chazal, between the conversation with the Zkenim, which starts Shmuel's kind of nervousness, because he's hearing a kind of rejection of him, rejection of everything that he's accomplished, rejection, right? There's no Akar Satov, there's no, right, where's the, you reject Shmuel because of the possibility that his sons aren't going to walk in his footsteps, like what's the complete disconnect? And then he realizes very quickly, as God says to him, completely different agenda here. And a very evil, a very dangerous agenda that's going on amongst the masses, who are rejecting far more than just your accomplishments and your leadership. Now,
it's got the kochal ha'goyim again.
So we're going to come back. This is exactly what we're going to talk about right now. This phrase, kochal ha'goyim, seems to be a kind of a thorn issue. Because it starts in the Torah, and it starts here, and it starts here again. Right? There's a constant theme of reference to this kochal ha'goyim, and the Mefarshim struggle with the question whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. On the one hand, Torah commands and states, and so many times, not to imitate the goyim, not to walk in their ways, not to do what they do, not to be influenced by their idolatry, etc. On the other hand, the Torah very clearly stated that the mitzvah of appointing a king is defined by the model of nations around them. Go back to Dvarim Perek Yud Zayin. So this is where I want to deal with this issue once and for all, if you will. Yeah, we'll come back. This is at some point we kind of reference them and then deal with them at some point. Tvarim Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Dalet. Tvarim. Deuteronomy. 17:14. Ki tavo al ha'aretz asher Hashem Elokecha noten lach v'yirishta v'yeshavta ba. You'll come into the land God will give you. You'll inherit it. You'll settle in it. You'll conquer it. V'yamarta asim alai melech kechol ha'goyim asher sivivotai. You will say, give us a king. Appoint for us a king like all the nations around us. Som tasim alecha melech asher yivchar Hashem Elokecha bo. You must certainly appoint a king. Again, how to read that phrase is you must certainly appoint a king, period, or you must certainly appoint a king whom God will choose, depending on how to parse the phrase. Mikerev achecha tesim alecha melech, lo tuchal latet alecha ish nochri asher lo achicha hu. Your first prerequisite is that your king has to be from amongst your people, cannot be an outsider, cannot be a stranger, has to be, there is a requirement that the melech be a natural-born member of the Jewish people. Rak le'ad...
Ad ha'yom hazeh.
Correct. Rak le'ad... It's a mitzvah in the Torah. Rak le'ad abelo susim. Right? Can't have too many horses. V'lo yeshiva da'am mitzrayma leman harbot sus. In order to increase the number of horses, he'll take the people back to Egypt. That's a no-no. Hashem amar lachem lo tosifun lashuv baderech hazeh od. God has commanded you not to return to Egypt. Requirement number two. Requirement number three, v'lo yarbelu nashim v'lo yasur levavo. Can't have too many wives, lest they lead his heart astray. Classic example of, classic part of king culture was to have multiple wives in political marriages, but that brings all kinds of foreign cultures into the arena of the king of the palace. Read the story of Shlomo HaMelech with all of his thousands of wives. By the time, right, when he's young and strong and he can control them, it's one thing. By the time he gets old and his wives are bringing each one their own little deity and sticking on the mantle, suddenly he's got a palace full of idolatry. Nor can he amass too much gold and silver. How much too much gold and silver is, I don't know, but that's what it is. V'ya kishivto kisei mamlachto. Those are the negative commandments. Then there's a positive commandment. V'ya kishivto kisei mamlachto v'chatav lo et mishnei haTorah hazot al sefer lifnei haKohanim haLeviim. He has to write for himself a copy of the Torah from the Kohanim. V'ayta imo v'kara bo koyimei chayav. He has to hold it. He has to read it. Has to be with him all the days of his life. L'man yilmad liyirat Hashem elokav. In order that he should know that he is bound by the laws of the Torah, he has to read the Torah, he has to live by it, it's not above the law. These commandments are so that he does not become haughtier than his brothers and sisters. Very easy for a king to become arrogant. Prohibition against arrogance in the kingship is essentially what all of these mitzvot are designed to do. Not too much gold, not too much. The limitations on the kingship in order that he should not become too arrogant. And the commandment, the requirement that he recognize that he is bound by the laws of the Torah so that he does not veer right or left from the mitzvot. So that he and his children shall we remain kings of Israel for generations to come. That's the mitzvah of the Parshat HaMelech in its entirety. So why is there a phrase here, Kechol HaGoyim? If the Torah doesn't want us to be like all the nations, so why does the Torah go state, Ve'amarta asim alai melech Kechol HaGoyim? And how does that phrase relate or interact with the rest of the Parshat? This is really what I think is the from the pshat perspective. This is what if you read the whole parak, I think you get a better sense of what is going on. What's the relationship between the phrase "you will say," the introductory phrase "you will say," we want a king like all the nations, and the rest of the parsha?
Well, it starts off you'll choose this kind of government, but then this kind of government won't be like everybody else's.
Right. In other words, it's a limitation on the concept of a king. The Torah presents the mitzvah min ha-melech, and at the same time, like every other mitzvah in the Torah, and so many examples where the Torah presents concepts that are common to the world around them, and then restructures it so that it carries the character of the Torah and not the character of what everybody else is doing.
In other words, we'll have a king like other people have kings, but our king won't be like their king.
Exactly. That's the difference. You can have a king like the other nations, but it doesn't make you like every other nation.
But why is it so important that we have to be like the other nations?
That's what the Torah is saying. It's not. It's important that we have a king.
But it specifies saying Kechol HaGoyim. So you're saying
no.
Well, you
what it specifies is if you come and make the request that you want a king like Kechol HaGoyim,
right.
Torah says, okay, here's the king.
But the people are saying.
Correct, because that is exactly how the Torah anticipates what people say. Well, that's human nature. People
want to
be like everybody around them.
Right.
I absolutely understand the request.
About being under a king.
And this will be new for them to be under a king. There's a reason they want a king.
But it's not.
And we're
going to
talk about why they want a king.
But it's not going to be a king like what they think
the
nations are.
That's the message of the Torah. And that's the power of it.
Like living in Pharaoh's backyard.
There's also the sense of, you know how your kids nag you and nag you and nag you? They want something.
Right.
You know that they're not going to be happy with it, but you say, all right, you have to see for yourself.
So that comes back to the question of whether or not the Torah really, whether there's an ideal of having a king or whether it's a concession. And because most Mepharshim and most Poskim agreed that there was actually a mitzvah to appoint a king, then I would put a qualification on that. If they'd never asked for a king, if the people had never come to Shmuel and asked for a king, would they have eventually have gotten a king anyway? That's a question we're going to answer.
Okay.
And I would say the answer is yes. I would say the answer is yes, based on the part of the mitzvah in the Torah, based on, we still have to look at the Nevuah of Bilam, based on Sefer Shoftim, based on the promise to Abraham. There's so many references. And Melachim Mimchayetzeyu, which is the pasuk in Sefer Bereishit, that you will have kings. There's so many references to the fact that there would have been a king no matter whether they requested it or not. But if the request came in the form of if that's the way the request came, says the Torah, with the following provisions. Number one, Asher Omar Elecha. Right? Navi. Number two, Mikarev Achecha. Has to be
amongst your people.
From Yisrael, you can't take a foreign king. Number three, Lo Yarbe Lo Susim. Remarkable statement we're going to explore it in more detail. Can't have too many horses.
And that was one of the things that Shlomo ended up doing.
Lots of them.
Okay.
Right? We're going to talk about this at length. These three qualifications of the king are a major, major issue.
And about the wives. Not too many wives.
Lo Yarbe Lo Susim. Lo Yarbe Lo Nashim.
So we come after the Susim.
Lo Yarbeh Lo
Kesev.
Kesev is a havel Yarbeh Lo Ma'od. I'm just going to rewrite it for the sake of parallel. And finally, Yekatav Lo Sefer
Torah.
Mishneh Torah. There's six qualifications.
Does that mean you can't be a convert?
Yes, that is what it means. A convert cannot be a king.
No, I have a question about the horse.
A convert is like a foreign, it's like
naturalized
citizen. It's somewhat analogous on a different level to the Constitution's requirement that the president has to be a natural-born citizen. Right? There is a certain point at which, when you talk about the top position of leadership, you want somebody who's coming in from the word go.
And when you talk about the are you talking about 90%, 95%, 100%?
In those days, you never had, there's no communication with 100% of the people. So whatever, the people were coming, the stirring sentiment, if you will.
One of the functions of the king is to wage war.
Correct. One of the major functions of the king
right.
to wage war. And this puts a serious
I can say the quick
cramp
about the horses.
In that, we're going to talk
because
about that.
Possession of horses is what you need to
is
make
an
war.
Army. Right. Yeah. We're going to talk about that. Like saying to the to a modern army, you can have an army, but you can't have planes. No planes and tanks. Now go fight. Now go.
Right.
Now build an army. Right. That's exactly right. But all of this together essentially says one thing.
Our model's different.
And our melech is not kachol abayim. It's almost as if the entire message of the Torah is, I want you to have a king. But if you think the king is going to be kachol abayim, you're mistaken. Here's what your king is going to look like. And that's a whole different conversation. This is what the Torah wants. This is your ideal. This is a picture of
what a king should be. This is David. This is
like a
this
model.
Is your
this
is your model. This is your Melech HaMashiach. Whereas if you come and ask for a king Kochol HaGoyim, know that your mitzvah of the king is going to be different. And that's exactly how I think the Torah addresses the Kochol HaGoyim. It's not if you ask for a king, God says, okay, you can have a king, Nebuch, what else am I going to do? You want a king, you fretch about it long enough, I'll give you a king. Right? It's when you come and ask for a king correctly, but misplace the focus and say, we want a king because we want to be like all the other nations, then comes along the Torah and says, hey, wait a second, you're going to have a king. I want you to have a king. But no, that there is a very different context to this king, ideally, than simply to be like all the other nations, or even like a king like any other nation.
But isn't also that among the Goyim, that their king was the center of action, the king had unlimited power? This is saying the king is not the center, and the king does not have the absolute
in
power.
In every arena, not absolute power, he's bound by law. Limited military capabilities. Political alliances, limited
money.
Taxes and financial capabilities, limited appointment options because the Navi has to get involved. Right? So that's exactly the point. Now you have to ask who wants the job. Now you have to ask, so what is Melech Yisrael? Okay, so we're not Melech Kochol HaGoyim, we're Melech Yisrael. Okay, so what is that? A different concept. It shares in name only the word king, but after that, any comparison is purely, any parallel is purely accidental. That's the next part of the conversation. Now, having said that,
when the people asked for that, they didn't know the stipulations that there was
going to
be involved in it.
No, that's the whole point. The Torah stipulations
are. They didn't know any of that.
The Torah is presenting its stipulations in response
right,
to
I'm saying
if you come along, remember this is the Torah's anticipation, if you come along and say we want a king like all
well,
the other nations, know that this is what comes with the job. Part one. Now, this is something very we call close reading. Gemara says that there are two conversations going on in this parak. There's a conversation between the Zkenim and the conversation with the Am. Okay? Both of whom use the phrase Kochol HaGoyim. Both of whom use the phrase Kochol HaGoyim. Take a look at the phraseology of each. Let's start with Pasuk Daled, which is the request of the people. Of the Zkenim.
Back in Parakhat, Right, Kapzu calls Zikne Yisrael Vayavo El Shmuel Aramata Vayomru Ela Vinea Tazakanto Vanecha Lachubit Rechacha Ata Simulanu Melech
Lishavteinu
Okay? That's this game.
Now take a look at the response of the people after Shmuel reads to them the Mishpat HaMelech, which we still have to try to figure out what is the meaning of Mishpat HaMelech, comes to them and says, Pasuk Yitet, Vayima'anu ha'am lishmua b'kol Shmuel, Vayamru lo ki'im melech ya'aleinu. Number one.
Melech Ye Aleinu. Read the next phrase.
Vayinu
Kechol HaGoyim.
Kechol HaGoyim.
Ushvatanu.
Ushvatanu.
Malkeinu.
Next phrase.
V'yatzah Lefaneinu.
V'yatzah Lefaneinu.
V'nilcham
et milchamoteinu. In the conversation that the Zkenim have with Shmuel, is there any reference to war?
No.
No. What's the pretense of the conversation?
The Shoftana.
Right, and what's the catalyst to that conversation?
Yeah,
what's
the motivation? Sons
were the sons. They've got a problem with their sons being shoftim mishpat. And corruption of the mishpat, banachalochu bedrachecha, tnu lanu melech, l'shofteinu, kechol agoyim. Or, if I were to rewrite this, tnu lanu melech l'shofteinu, kechol agoyim. Okay, I agree with that for a reason. I'll show you in a moment.
Because they put the kol ha'goyim last.
Put the kol ha'goyim at the end, and the shofteinu is a qualification of the melech. What's the response of the people? Lo ki melech yealeinu. We want a king. Ve'inu gam anachnu kol ha'goyim. We also want to be like all the nations. U'shvatanu malkeinu. V'yatzal lefaneinu, he will judge us, he will go out before us. Latzet v'lavo is a description of a general leading his army into battle. V'nilcham et milchamoteinu, we want him to fight our battles for us. Worry. 2 hours, right?
Wars? War.
Worry.
One.
Milchamoteinu.
Yes, 2 hours.
2 hours? I-O-R,
so.
Right?
Yes.
Yes.
Why do you spell that? Always been better than English.
It's too
hard.
Yeah.
That's what they want. What do the Zkenim want?
Melech Shoftanu. They're not judged. They're not saying anything about a war.
They wanted a Shofet, like every other Shofet, but they had a problem, and they had a solution to that problem, which was a hereditary system of a Shofet, which we were going to call a Melech. Melech Shoftanu Kechol Avayim. I have a simple question. Which kechol agoyim matches the use of kechol agoyim as it appears in the
Sefer
Torah, in Sefer Dvar?
Zkenim.
Because?
That's
what it says. Asima lai melech kechol agoyim. Doesn't say l'shaftenu in either case. But the phrase is asima lai melech kechol agoyim. We want a king like all the nations. Melech kechol ha'goyim. Melech kechol ha'goyim. To which the Torah says, Melech, okay, not so much like kechol ha'goyim, but that's fine. What do the people say?
That they should be...
That they'll be
like
all...
Kechol ha'goyim.
Right.
They'll be like all the people.
We want a melech.
So we can be like everybody.
Mehayinu kechol ha'goyim. There is a world of difference between we want a melech like a melech exists in other nations, similarly melech kechol ha'goyim, to which the Torah can say, here's your melech, but let's put caveats and limitations and changes to the qualifications of the melech. There is a world of difference between that and we want a melech because we want to be like kechol ha'goyim. Ve'yinu gam anachnu kechol ha'goyim.
Look where the shoftenu is there.
And the shoftenu is part of a description of the warrior characteristics. Take the word, remember, the word shofet has two meanings, and it's a constant play on the word. Because the shofet can be a judge in a judicial sense, and the shofet can be a shofet of sefer shoftim, which is a military role. They're talking about shofet in a judicial sense. Shmuel was a shofet who went around to all the people after the no wars. When Shmuel's described as a shofet, when his sons are described as shoftim, there are no wars they're fighting. That's a judicial context. They want a melech in a judicial context. Part of the role of a king is to adjudicate. Shlomo melech sat in judgment with all his wisdom. The people, they couldn't care less about judgment. They got a much bigger issue. Hey, I couldn't care less about the Beit Mishpat. The Beit Mishpat can go jump in a lake. They want a king because they want a warrior. They want a general. And how we get to that role of a king, that's a whole different conversation. That's the role that God says to Shmuel. Listen carefully to what they're asking for. Listen very carefully. Zkeinim sha'alu kohogen. When they formulated the question, Simulanu melech l'shafteinu k'chol ha'goyim, they formulated the question correctly. Whether it's the right solution to the right problem or not, but you can't hold them accountable for that. They're looking for a solution, and their phraseology is correct. Melech k'chol ha'goyim is exactly what the Torah states. Whereas the Am, the Am Ha'aretz, or the Amcha, if you will, their agenda is completely different. This is a direct rebellion. And that's what God says to Shmuel. They're not rebelling against you as a shofet. Lo otcha ma'asu, ki im oti ma'asu. They are rebelling against me. This is a direct rebellion against God. How? That's our next agenda.
So Hashem already knows he's not going to listen to Shmuel when he says, go tell him the rules about the king.
I think it's a foregone conclusion that he's going to tell them what the rules of a king are, and they're going to say,
they're not
gonna listen. A test. It's to prove that this is really what they want. If you are if you're this Canaan, and what you want is a judiciary, then the last thing in the world you want to do is to create a system of forced conscription. You want justice, you want tzedek, because you want righteousness, you want justice, you don't want forced conscription. There's no such thing as a just draft. It doesn't work. You want a strong military, then you want the forced conscription, but then you're not going to get justice. The two requests are mutually exclusive. You're either going to get tzedek or you're going to get an army, but you're never going to get both.
Why is that?
Because forced conscription is never just. Go read the laws of the king. Certainly in the history of Tanakh, probably in the history of mankind. Until modern times, maybe. Forced conscription has never been a just system. It's maybe a necessary system. But it's never just. It's never tzedek. And that's the conflict here. These two requests are at direct odds with each other. It's not just two different agendas. They're two different conflicting agendas. One wants a strong army. And we know they want a strong army. What's the motivation to the people's request for a king? What's driving their request for a king? Why do they listen to Shmuel's description of the powers of the king to force conscription? Because that's what he describes to them. They're going to take your sons, they're going to take your daughters, they're going to take your land, he's going to take everything. Why? Because he's going to build his army. And the people are dancing in the streets. They say, yes, Shmuel, music to our ears. That's what we want. We want a strong army. Whereas this Canaan, they're sitting in their boots. They don't want an army at all. They want a king who's going to sit in the Supreme Court and judge cases in the court system. You can't have a warrior king out in the battlefield and expect justice. These are mutually exclusive arenas. And David HaMelech is probably the greatest warrior Jewish history has ever seen. I wouldn't call his tenure as king a period of mishpat of tzedek, even though the Tehillim calls it mishpat v'tzedek in terms of David, but it's very hard to really administer just tzedek internally properly when you're leading an army against war after war. Well, Shlomo Melech, what's he most famous for? Sitting in judgment, sitting in the palace, and people come from all over the world to hear the wisdom of his judgment, right? Never lifted a finger in battle a day in his life. They're almost mutually exclusive arenas. And that's the conflict here. What's driving the request of the people?
They must feel vulnerable.
They feel vulnerable, right? And Shmuel says, he accuses them of it directly. In Perek Yud Bet, when we read through the Perek, we read through quickly, but I want to go back to that for a moment. Turn to Perek Yud Bet, This is Shmuel discusses the ills and evils of kingship twice. Once when they first request it, and again after he's appointed Shaul, which always gets me worried about. You know, Shaul was standing there and listening to Shmuel describe to the people how terrible it was that they asked for a king. And here he is. This is the king you wanted. His name is Shaul. He's your king. Terrible thing that you asked for a king. Terrible. Be careful what you wish for. Here's your king. His name is Shaul. He's standing there. It's a remarkable story. But that's exactly what happens in Perek Yudbet. Starting with the beginning. Vayomer Shmuel al kol Yisrael, hinei shamati b'kolchem. Shmuel says to the people, I've listened to you. I gave you a king. Here's your king. And then I'm going to go reread this, the next set of psukim. He chastises them for requesting a king. He says, I didn't do anything to you. You rejected me. And have I been corrupt? Have I done anything to take something that didn't belong to me? Have I behaved inappropriately on any level? And they say, of course not. So then they said, so he says, okay, so then you see how terrible it is that you requested a king, and he gives them a very long history and Musr Shmuz. And at the end of it, he says, not at the end of it, the middle of it. Pasuk Aleph. Vayishlach Hashem et Yerubbaal v'et Bedan v'et Yiftach v'et Shmuel. All of these times that you served idols, and God gave you into the hands of enemies, and you... Yeah, you know, we need to read this. Let's go back a few psukim. Pasuk Tet. Vayishkechu et Hashem elokehem, vayimkor otam b'yad sisra sar tzvachatzor, v'yad plishtim, v'yad melech Moab, v'yilachamu bam. Every time the people rebelled against God, God sold them into the hands of enemies. Sisra, plishtim, Moab. It's a review of Sefer Shoftim. Vayizaku al Hashem, they cried out to God. Vayomachatanu, they said, we sinned. Gezavnu at Hashem and avodat baalim et ashtarot. We abandoned God. We worshipped idolatries. We worshipped Baal and Ashtoret. Ve'atatzileinu miyadoveinu v'navdeka. God, save us, and we will be loyal to you. That's the recurring cycle of Sefer Shoftim. In three psukim, that's the whole book. One pasuk per year that it took us to learn the Sefer. Vayishlach Hashem et Yerubbaal v'et Bedan v'et Yiftach v'et Shmuel. God sent Shoftim after Shofet after Shofet after Shofet. Yerubbaal is Gidon. Bedan is Shimshon. Yiftach is Yiftach. Shmuel. It's a very famous drush of Chazal. Yiftach bedor kishmuel bedor. Every generation you deal with the leadership that you have in that generation. That's who you have. Right? And if your leadership is Yiftach, then that's who your leadership is, and you're loyal to him. And if your leadership is Shmuel, then that's who your leadership is, and you're loyal to him. Yiftach b'dor k'Shmuel b'dor. Vayatzel etchem miyad oyvechem. He has saved you from the hands of your enemies. Misavi. Vateshu betach. And you were dwelling securely. You were dwelling safely. Look at Shmuel. Right, the last reference here is to Shmuel. After Shmuel Perek Zion, they fought wars. They fought back the Plishtim. And now everything is great, hunky-dory. They got rid of the idolatry. There's no more idolatry. They're living happily with there's no Mishkan. Okay, so be it. But they're loyal to God, and they are there's no war. The Plishtim are pushed back. Vateshu betach. They're living quietly and securely until. Vatiru ki nachash melech b'nei Amon ba'alechem. You saw the looming threat in the distance of Nachash, king of Amon. Amon Moab, remember our neighbors to the east. You saw the army of Amon begin to move, and you got scared. Vatomru li, lo ki melech yimloch aleinu. We want a king. Hashem elokechem malkechem. Hashem is your king. Shmuel understood exactly what they were requesting. But what's the connection between Nachash and the request for a king? In Perek Chet, there's no reference to Nachash, king of Ammon, at all. This reference to the marching army of Nachash b'nei Ammon, Melech b'nei Ammon, is not there. We'll see it in Perek Tet. Sorry, we'll see in Perek Yud and Yud Aleph. The war with Ammon. And that was Shaul's first military battle, military campaign was against Nachash Melech ben Ammon. So Shmuel says to him, I got you. I understand. You didn't say it back in Perek Chet. But I understood you better than you think. What's driving your request for a king is not Mishpat v'tzedek. It's v'yetzal lefaneinu v'nechamet melchamateinu. You want the warrior. But understand that that's a terrible, terrible sin. And that's exactly why he says to them, right, next piece is the test. If this was a mistake, let the heavens open up in the middle of the summer and the skies and start to rain, and suddenly it starts to rain. This was a terrible mistake. This was a rebellion against God. And so one of the issues we now have to address is, why is it that a request for a king as a warrior, which is one of the missions and mandates and purposes of a king, why is that in fact
so terrible?
That's the question. So really, this is the beginning of the conversation. What is it about a king and the power of a king and the mandate of a king that's different from a shofet, that carries with it such an intense theological rejection, separate from the ideal of a king, which, on the contrary, is something which the Torah wanted and encouraged and set forth. That's what this conversation.
The catalyst to all of this?
That's what Shmuel says to them. He accuses them of saying that, although they didn't say it explicitly, he accuses them of seeing Nahash out in the distance, on the horizon, as the catalyst to the request of a king. Right. Excuse me?
Like Janet said before, they felt vulnerable.
They had felt vulnerable before. For 350 years, they have gone through a cycle of feeling vulnerable. They've never made this request for a king. Right. Something's gone on here, and that's something which is, especially in the aftermath of Shmuel, who was so successful at dealing with the Plishtim, could have easily have dealt with Nachash ben Melech ben Ammon. That's our conversation. So I want to spend a few minutes and just talk about 10 minutes. I think we can do this. Talk about what is the nature of the request of a king and how a king differs from a shofet in this regard. What is it? Why was the shofet inadequate for them? And what makes a melech different from a shofet in the military context? Remember, it's a shofet in Sefer Shoftim. I'm not talking about a judicial shofet. I'm talking about a Sefer Shoftim shofet. Neil ben Knaz, Zeir ben Gera, Tavoran Barak, Gidon, Yiftach, Shmuel, that whole list of shoftim, they all fought wars.
Right.
They all fought battles. They all led the people to victory. Was is given as Ashlecht? What was so terrible? It worked for 350 years. So there are hints to this that we looked at back in Sefer Shoftim. When we learned through Sefer Shoftim, we sort of, every once in a while, we picked up on this theme and we pointed to it and we said, oh, remember this, we'll come back to it.
Okay.
Right?
Does it have something to do with that the shofet was appointed by Hashem?
And no, because the melech also needs to be appointed but the melech, the dynasty of the melech also needs to be appointed by Hashem. Again, I'm going to leave the Kol HaGoyim out of the picture for now, because
I'm just saying the way I'm thinking.
Not even so worried. I think that the issue of dynasty is so weighing on their shoulders.
But when was the
right? Because in the end, they've had kings that didn't have dynasties. Right, his Shaul did not have a dynasty; he was a king.
Yeah.
They had lots of kings later on that lasted one generation. So, kings can be dynastic, but so from Shoftim, Shmuel appointed his sons. Yiftach, Gidon appointed his sons. Yair Giladi and Avdon Ben Hillel all appointed the sons of Shoftim. So Shoftim can also be dynastic. It's not necessarily mandated as such, but it can be. So I'm not sure the dynasty is such a big issue here, In fact, I'm pretty sure that I think they're. It's hard to understand how the dynasty fits into the warrior model. But there's a different power to the king.
Yeah. When was the last time, though, that they had a shofet that was a military shofet?
Shmuel.
Okay.
Shmuel led them. It was Paragzai. Led them into the battle against against the Plishtim.
Shmuel was Navi and Shofet.
Okay. Correct, which was unique. That comes back to Moshe Rabbeinu. That was great. You know what they say? If it was good enough for Moshe, right? But there's something in the heart of Shmuel's description, the Mishpat HaMelech, that I think is the key to understanding this issue.
Something to do with
Kol HaGoyim? No. Kol HaGoyim, again, Kol HaGoyim constantly takes us off into a different direction, which I don't believe is the source of the issue. I think that they misunderstood it, misread it, misapplied it, but the crux of the issue lies in the role of the shofet. When Shmuel describes to them Mishpat HaMelech, take a look at the list of characteristics. And Shmuel describes in great detail the mandate of the king. Zeyeh Mishpat HaMelech Hashem Imloch Alechem. God says to Shmuel, tell the people, what is the Mishpat HaMelech? And he tells them, ביום הזה יהיה משפט המלך השם ימלוך עליכם, את בניכם ייקח, ושם לו במרכבתו ובפרשיו. He will take your sons. What will he take your sons for? He'll put them into his chariots and his horses. Now, again, the Torah says, לא יבל לא סוסים, so I'm not sure how many chariots he's supposed to have, but he'll certainly have chariots. וירצו לפני מרכבתו. He'll have your sons running before his chariot. ולשום לו שרי אלפים ושרי חמישים ולחלוש חרישו ולקצור קציבו ולעשות כלי מלחמתו, כלי רכבו. He will take your sons and he will force them into positions of officership over tens and thousands and over fifties, and they will plow his fields and harvest his flock and forge his
weapons
of war. That's your sons. Ved benotechem yikach, they'll take your daughters. What will you take your daughters for?
Do all the other things that need to be done.
Correct. Le'rakachot, an army runs on its, moves on its stomach. Right. So somebody's got to cook for an army that he's just created with all of his chariots and horses.
In this translation, it says perfumers.
That's the rakachot. You also, in those days, you needed perfumers too for armies because
they smell.
Right. It's an army. Ve'etzdotechem ve'etkarmechem.
I just wondered if there was another. There's no other meaning. It's literal.
That's what
okay.
It says.
Okay.
I think that's part of what there was. Stotechem ve'etkarmechem ve'zetechem atovim. All of your crops and your vineyards and your fields. Yikach. He's going to take those too. Because a king can. He can confiscate land. Why can he confiscate land? Why can a king confiscate land?
Because he owns it.
He's the king.
Because he's the king. He can do what he wants? No. Why does the king need land?
He needs it. Yeah.
Why does he need land?
Power.
What it grows?
Right. Land grows fields. Fields grow crops. Crops grow food. Food, food
feeds armies.
Feeds armies. Thank you very much. Food feeds armies. And he'll take whatever crops you grow and he'll tie them and he'll take them. And he'll give them to his servants. He'll take all your servants and your maidservants and he'll put them into his service. He'll take your flock, your sheep, and you will be his slaves. Z'aktem b'yamohu. Milifnei malkechem asher b'chartem lachem. You'll cry out from the oppression of the king who's going to force you into conscription. You think this is just? To steal your lands and to take your sons and your daughters? That's mishpat? That's tzedek? There is no tzedek. There is no justice in a forced conscription than a king who can take your sons and your daughters and your servants and your maidservants and your land and your crops and your flock and your sheep, all because he has to, ostensibly because he has to
wage war.
And war costs money, and war takes soldiers, and war takes people, and in order to do what you want, which is to wage war, he's going to create, take everything that belongs to you. You will become his slaves. And you know what they answered? That's what we want. Yeah, Shmuel, you got it right. That's exactly what we want. We want a king.
People hear what they want to hear.
Right? Why? Because they're not worried about justice and tzedek. They want one thing.
Protection.
They want an army. They want the army of Israel. They want an army. And to have an army, standing, permanent military presence to protect them on their borders, they need a king. Every characteristic in this parak of Mishpat HaMelech revolves around the creation of a standing, permanent army. That's exactly what the people wanted. And Shmuel got it. That's why he said to them in Perek Yudbet, you heard that Nachash Melech Ammon was coming to attack, and what did you do? You started to clamor for a king. You hit it with all kinds of agendas. Your sons, and the righteousness, and the mishpat, and then the corruption of the courts. You tried to hide it well. But I saw right through it. You saw Nachash on the horizon, Nachash Melech Bnei Ammon, you came and you wanted a king. Know that a king means he's going to turn you all into his slaves and turn you all into his soldiers. It's the exact opposite of any sense of tzedek. And that's what they said. Yes, we want a king. Go back to Gideon. The first reference to kingship that we saw, the first hint to kingship that we saw was in Sefer Shoftim. And we saw it by Gideon. Why did we see it by Gideon? I came to Gideon after his great military battle against... Gideon was probably the biggest military victory in Sefer Shoftim. Do you remember the story of Gideon?
No, because we haven't started yet.
He started with 30,000 soldiers. God said too many. Went to 10,000 soldiers. God said too many. Then he went to 300 soldiers. He took those 300 soldiers and he put torches in their hands and pitchers in their hands so that in the middle of night it looked like each they made noise and they were torches and it looked like they were each one was. And then he surrounded the army of the nomads of Amalek and Bnei Kedem. Not only did he wage war against them and scare them out so that they ran away, but then they ran all the way to chase them all the way to Midian, which was like on the other side of Saudi Arabia. It was a famous story where it's the only battle in Sefer Shoftim where the shofar took the campaign out of the territory of the land of Israel into the territory of the enemy. I even shared with you the connection to modern Israel because there's a famous book written about the operation called Sword of Gideon, which was called Cherev Gideon, the Sword of Gideon, precisely because it was the Israeli Secret Service operation to assassinate the terrorists who were responsible for the Munich massacre.
And that was called the Sword of Gideon.
Right. Why?
Well, I don't know,
because there was all over the world. Because it took the soldiers to attack the enemy Bashir Hisham wherever they were found. And so they called it Cherev Gideon. That was the operation. There's a book called The Sword of Gideon, which is the story of that. Offensive of the Secret Service. What did they do with Gideon? Take a look. Let's go back to the story of Gideon for a moment. Shoftim. We're going to start at the end. We're going to start at Perek Chet. Chafbet. They come to after Gidon finished the entire campaign. They come to Gidon, Vayamu Ish Yisrael Gidon. They come to Gidon and they said, Mishol Banu. Mishol Banu means rule over us. Gamata, Gam Bincha, Gam Ben Bincha, meaning
like
dynasty. This is the request for kingship. This is the first real request for a king. They don't call it a king. They don't need to. What they really want was Shmuel. Gidon was such a warrior. He was such a successful warrior. They want to preserve that warrior, that army, that sense of power. So they said to you, rule over us, Mishol Banu. You, your sons, your grandson, your great-grandson. Ki hosha'atanu miyad Midyan. They're not afraid to say it because you saved us from the hands of Midyan. Now, after everything is said and done, remember how the story of Gidon began, where Gidon was told he has to destroy the idol of Baal, he has to destroy his father's idols, right, or altar. This isn't Gidon who saved them. This was God. Why did he start with 30,000 soldiers and God said to him, it's too many soldiers, whittle it down to 10,000. And then after the 10,000, he said, no, you're going to whittle that down to 300. Why did God tell him that it's too many soldiers? Why couldn't he go to war with 30,000? Because God said to him explicitly, it's too many. Back in Perek Zion, Pasuk Bet. Vayomer Hashem al Gidon, Rav ha'am asher itach. Too many. Mititi et midyan biyadam. You have too many soldiers for me to give Gidon, Midyan into your hands. Pen yitpa'er ala Yisrael lemor, lest Israel have the arrogance to say, Yadi Hoshiali, I saved myself. What did they say to Gidon? Ki mi hosha'atanu miyad Midyan. You saved us in the hands of Midyan. It's exactly what God was afraid of. Vayomer Elohim Gidon. And Gidon got the message, just maybe a little bit too little too late. And he said, Lo emshol ani bachem, I won't rule over you. V'lo yimshol bani bachem, my sons won't rule over you. Hashem moshel bachem, yimshol bachem. God rules over you. Create a military army. Create a standing army. Create a military power with a king, the warrior, and with horses and chariots and wealth and power and tanks and planes. And what's the next step? Right. Look how powerful we are. Look what we can accomplish. We are invincible. The whole message of the Torah's presentation of a king is, you want a king, have a king. But you can't have a strong army. You can't have horses and chariots. You can't have gold and silver. And you can't have political alliances. You can't have a military power in the world, because the only military power is the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the irony of it. So we'll come back to a question after. So what is the purpose of a king? But this is the conversation. In Gidon's case, Gidon is a victim of his own. He's a prime example of everything that can go wrong in kingship. Because how does the story of Gidon end? After they conquered Midian, and they took from Midian all of the gold and all of the silver and all of the camels and all of the horses and all of the animals, and he built himself an empire. And he took all the gold and silver and he turned it into an ephod. Remember the ephod that he had hanging up in his hometown, in his home city?
Was he a Kohen?
No, he wasn't a Kohen. It was a monument to his... the monument. We went through all this. He had an army, and he had money, and he had, well, he even had. How's the story end? Pasuk Lamed, Vayomer Anshei Ha'ir. Parakhet. Pasuk Lamed. Vayelech Yerubal ben Yoash Vayeshe Beveto. Ulegidon Ayu Shivim Banim Yotzei Yerecho Ki Nashim Rabot Ayu Lo. He had 70 sons because he had many wives. Between the money and the horses and the camels and the gold and the wives, he had all the ills that the Torah says a king is not allowed to have. And how did he get his 30,000 soldiers? Devorah, remember the story of Devorah and Barak? Devorah, who sent out a call and asked for volunteers from all over the country. And she got from five different tribes came to assist in her campaign. And what was the total size of her army? And at that time it was huge. 10,000 soldiers. Gidon, Perek Vav, Pasuk Lamed Dalet. Ruach Hashem Lashad Gidon, Vaitka b'shofar, Vayizaek Aviezer Acharav. Gidon blew the shofar, and the tribe of Aviezer, which is a sub-tribe of Menasheh. Gidon, Devorah from five tribes had an army of 10,000. Gidon blew the shofar, and from a sub-tribe of one tribe of Menasheh, they came. Umalachim shalach b'chom Menasheh, Vayizaek Amu Acharav, the rest of Menasheh was called. Umalachim shalach b'asher b'zvulun v'naftali, another three tribes. Now he's got this whole group, right? How many does he have? 30,000. And he turns in Perek Zion, Pasuk Gimel, Ve'ata krana bozne ha'am lemor, turn to the people and say, Mi arei v'chared, anybody who's afraid, go home. When he sent out a call and he said, when God said to him, no, there's too many here, send some of them home. So he says, okay, guys, anybody who's afraid can go home. 22,000 left. 10,000 remained. Same size as the army of Devorah. Then God said to Gidon, okay, still too many. Now we're going to whittle it down to 300. How did 30,000 show up? 32,000 show up in the first place if they're all afraid? How did 32,000 show up if they're all afraid? Do you remember what happened in the city of Penuel and Sukkot when Gidon was chasing the army of Midian out and he crosses over the Jordan River and he gets to two Jewish towns of Penuel and Sukkot and he asks to give lodging and water to his soldiers? And they wouldn't do it because remember? Because they weren't sure how this battle was going to end. And so the response was, HaRosh Zevach V'Tzamuna B'yadchem, would you have the heads of the two generals, Zevach and Tzamuna, in your hands? When you have the heads of their generals in your hands, come back to us and we'll side with you. But in the meantime, we're staying neutral. What did Gidon do when he got back with the heads of Zevach and Tzamuna in his hands? What did he do to the cities of Penuel and Sukkot?
Probably destroyed them.
He killed them all.
That sounds biblical.
He killed them all. Because they dared
to oppose him.
And you wonder why 32,000 came when Gidon blew the shofar and they all came running. He was a tyrant. He was an absolute tyrant. He blew the shofar and they all came running. And when he said to them, okay, you know what? I'll let those who are afraid go home. Two-thirds of them left. They didn't want to be there in the first place. So why do they come? Because Gidon blew the shofar. And you dared not cross him. And the two cities that did cross him paid the price for it. That was a king. That was the kind of king they wanted. That's where they came to Gidon and they said, Mishol banu gamata gam mincha gam ben mincha. That's what they wanted. They wanted the strength of an army. If there's any theme in Sefer Shoftim, it's the fact that in the absence of an army, they'll have an army. A Shofet will come to save them, and they'll get their volunteers' armies, right? The Shofet always has a volunteer army. There's never a conscripted army. There's no forced conscription in Sefer Shoftim. It's always a volunteer army. They'll get their volunteer militia, and they'll get the Shofet. And what's the cost for that?
They have to follow the Torah.
Right.
If they saw Gidon,
they have to follow the Torah. They have to do tshuva. It's a nemach, it's a price tag that comes with the shofet. It's true. It's a price tag.
So right? That's exactly what they didn't want with tshuva.
Right.
They didn't want that.
They're tired of the game. They're tired of the game. Every time there's an enemy, they've got to do tshuva, and then there'll be a shofet, and then there'll be an army, and then they'll sign, and then they'll do it again. They're tired of the game. So you have a solution. You take a Gidon. or you take a Shaul, you take whatever it is, you take a king, and you give him a permanent army, then guess what? I get to go home and not worry about it anymore. I get to sit in my house and never be bothered again, because army will save me. I have a permanent military army sitting on my borders, and I don't have to do anything spiritually about it, because the army will save me. That's why the request for a king was a rebellion against God. It's a rejection of the core of what Sefer Shoftim was about.
So they didn't want another Shmuel. They wanted something else.
And seeing what Gidon did to as a tyrant wasn't enough to turn them off.
No, they wanted it. They wanted the power.
Yeah.
They wanted somebody with that kind of power that they could stand behind and let everybody else who crosses him pay the price. That's exactly what they want.